Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast with me, Sam Harris, your host. I invite fascinating humans from all walks of life to share their wisdom and unpack their mindsets and formulas for growth.
Hello and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today we have Rachel Carroll on the show, who is the CEO of Coru Kids, who are building the world's best childcare service. And she was previously the CEO of Dr. Tom, a healthcare company which grew to 1.3 million paying customers. And you've actually had a pretty interesting life story that you were just telling me about, although right now you're a bit more conventional with the normal amount of kids, family, and running a business. So I don't think it's that conventional, running a business and trying to do everything all at once. Like, one whole topic we could go into is how to run a business whilst having kids, which is something that the idea of just completely scares me. Trying to run a business and have a girlfriend is enough for me to deal with, and I haven't yet worked that part out.
Yeah, I mean, so, if you find out the answer, tell me, because I'm not sure either, but giving you a
cool. Okay, well, anyway, welcome to the show. And I'd love to just kick off with a bit of a understanding of who you are and what kind of made you in terms of what you were curious about as a child and where that kind of led you into the world of like being an adult.
Yeah. So I grew up in a really small sheep farming town in New Zealand, at the very south of New Zealand. And it was a very, very, very safe, very boring, very flat. The thing it's famous for is having very wide streets, which, like, as things to be famous for, is probably one of the most boring, famous things you can ever be famous for. And so I grew up in this like very, very kind of safe environment, and everything I wanted to do was like get out of it and get into the action. And I wasn't sure where the action was, but I knew for certain that it wasn't where I was. And so the first part of my life was really just trying to find ways to get out. And the way that I hit on was basically entering competitions. And I used to enter, I was like a competition junkie. You sometimes read about these people in magazines, these people who like enter thousands of competitions. So I just did that. And I won all sorts of things when I was a kid, like a lot of semi-useless stuff. Like, I remember there was a period of time where I kept winning teacups. And even now when I go home to my parents' house, their cupboards are full of like my old teacups that I won for some reason.
Wow.
And it was basically how I got pocket money. And I used to kind of write into magazines and like the ones that paid you for published letters. So that was like my first entrepreneurial experience. I'm not even really sure if it's entrepreneurial, like winning competitions.
I'm going to say it
anyway,
counts.
It was sort of my hobby. Yeah. So I sort of graduated from teacups and like $10 for letter of the week or whatever to trying to win like scholarships and kind of bigger things, like basically all tickets out of town. And so then I, you know, was lucky enough to win some, and I managed to get myself over to England and get to university over here, which was something I definitely couldn't have afforded to do without that. And then I found my way into business, and I had just always really loved business. I'd always set up little schemes. I was quite a schemer as a kid, like as well as the entering competitions thing. I was weird, like used to wander around my school with a box of chocolate bars. I was sort of like a portable shop, and people could just like stop me and like buy a chocolate bar off me at like a, you know, 100% markup or something. I did so many things like that when I was a kid, all just kind of like scrabbling around for like something else, basically.
Nice. I didn't enter so many competitions in the newspaper, but I entered a lot of random competitions. And actually, my first business was because I entered a competition in the middle of my first year uni exams, because I'd basically passed and was sort of just procrastinating from doing revision, and to the business competition, then won. I had to start a business over summer in my first year. But then I also was the kid selling sweets and stuff at school, and entered a lot of food competitions as well. And later graduated into doing speed eating and chili eating contests and stuff. And
brilliant. Do you know what is probably the single most common background of like founder friends that I know is I don't share this one, but it's just incredible how many founders got their start doing nightclub promotion, like running events at university. I think it's the single most common founder background, but it doesn't happen to be mine.
Yeah, same. Also not my background, but I know a lot of friends, and I ran the university's business incubator after I finished my first business, and had a lot of people that had either been running nightclub events, then start a business, or actually turn a nightclub into an event into like a much bigger thing. And I'm still friends with them, and they've now gone on to other things. So it's, just like a common entrepreneurial way to sort of gather people around buying something, I guess, and then realize that you're able to do that and get into the idea of running a business, I guess. Cool. That's interesting. And then since getting out of uni and thinking about business and stuff, you've ran too. Have you had any other businesses that you sort of would you call like a proper business that you started but then failed at out of interest?
No, I haven't. I was somewhat risk averse, I think. So I didn't start that online Dr. One. I didn't found it, unfortunately. I wish I had. I took over that. So I went to McKinsey straight out of uni for 6 years, and then I left McKinsey and became the CEO of that online doctor service.
Right.
And I was really lucky to be given that job because it's really hard to come out of management consulting and go into the startup world. A lot of people don't trust that consultants can basically do the kind of startup, like getting your hands dirty. But I managed to get someone to take a chance on me, and I got this CEO role. And I really wanted to do the CEO role. That was what I decided was like my thing. Basically, because I never wanted to specialize. Mm. I'm just a massive generalist. Same. I don't have any specialties at all.
Yeah, it's a funny one. That's interesting. Because, yeah, they do say women are generally a bit more cautious and risk averse, but more likely to be successful, which, as in between the two of us, I've started many more things apparently, but I've failed at most of them. And you seem to be a bit more on point. And do you think that going through management consulting was helpful to have like that background in just seeing how people work and how to manage them and stuff before getting into starting?
Hugely. I think it teaches you a bunch of things that are really helpful in great depth, like the analytical skills, the sort of problem structuring, like the kind of creating strategy, just how to attack problems, a lot of problem solving skills, and a lot of people management and kind of team management, project management. But you also have these huge gaps as well. So there's a lot of things it doesn't teach you. Like, you don't learn anything about sales at all. That's definitely something I've had to fill in. And the kind of people that you work with when you do management consulting, they tend to be really smart and extremely motivated. And it's really easy to lead those people. Like, you basically just point them in the direction of a problem and say, go, and get out of their way, and they just go off and do it. So it's like the easiest management you've ever done. And so I've had to learn, you know, not everyone is actually that easy to manage. Mm. And so I've had to learn how to do that.
Yeah, that's interesting. If you were to give me a number one tip that people usually get wrong, but should do when it comes to people management, what would it be?
I think I tend to think about trust a lot. I think trust is the key to absolutely everything. I think trust is the foundation stone that allows you to not micromanage, that allows you to like manage more people because you don't have to be involved with each one so much. It allows communication to be faster. It allows people to be more fully bought in with everything about them. So like trust is just this massive unlock. And I think you can do a lot as a leader to actually create trust. Trust isn't something that is like, it's not just an output. It's not something that you go, oh, it, you know, that it exists or it doesn't, like, and kind of throw your hands up. You can, as a leader, do a lot to increase trust. So we do lots and lots of our practices at Coro Kids are specifically aimed at increasing trust. I think especially now that people are working more remotely, this is even more important because you have to be much more deliberate. It doesn't naturally happen so much. You can still have high trust environments, but you have to be more deliberate about creating them. So, for example, I think one of the ingredients is emotional vulnerability. And that's something you can demonstrate as a leader. And if you yourself role model being emotionally vulnerable and you encourage other people to do the same and you show that it's okay and, you know, there aren't bad consequences and actually you feel better and you're accepted and there's actually positive consequences from it, then that's some ways that you can kind of encourage and role model it. That's one component of building trust between people. And then once you've got that firm foundation of trust, I think just so much else follows from it.
Interesting. Can be a hard one to do, and especially I think part of starting off a business is often not having all the answers and trying to kind of connect the dots for people, when often you kind of don't want to kind of show the fact that you don't know everything sometimes, but actually it can be better to be sort of vulnerable and show that you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And that you're making mistakes, totally, that this plan is something you just made up 5 minutes ago.
Exactly. No, you have to get over that. Like, that is not helping anyone because it's not fooling anyone. The only people it's fooling are people who are like incredibly dense or incredibly like stupid or slow. And you really shouldn't have those people like in your team as a startup anyway. So like the people who you want to have in your team, it's not fooling them. And it's just creating a barrier to trust because it's putting up walls. And in fact, it doesn't matter. Like, of course you don't know. That's totally fine.
Yeah. Do you have a good example of something where you consciously made a decision to do something that you're uncomfortable with doing, but definitely helped show that you were being emotionally vulnerable?
I probably have some sort of like big bang moments, but I actually try more to do it in the everyday tiny little things way. So as one really practical example, we start a lot of our meetings, not all of them, but you know, let's say two or three a week with what we call an emotional check-in. Yes. And so I do this with my exec team. So I'm there on Tuesday morning and I have my, you know, me and my COO and my chief product officer and my chief tech officer and like two GMs that run part of my business and my marketing person, my finance director. So we're all there. And the very first thing we do is we go around and we do what's called an emotional check-in. And it's when you just talk about how you're feeling. And that could be kind of cringy or fake, but because we've been doing this for a long time and because we do trust each other and because we have already like role modeled it for like a year or two now, what actually happens is people are just extremely honest. And, you know, people will say things like, you know, I slept terribly last night. You know, I woke up in the morning, in the middle of the night, feeling anxious about like COVID or something. And so I'm not, you know, I'm sort of got brain fog this morning or something like that. Like, but they'll say things like this, or they'll say like, you know, I'm really worried. My kid's got like a funny rash and my wife's just taken her to the doctor and she's really on my mind. So I'm not like fully present right now. And whatever it is, like that is genuinely how they are. And what it means, like really practically, imagine if you had that person, right, who's like really tired or they, you know, their kid's getting checked out for their rash or whatever. And imagine if you were trying to pitch an idea in the meeting to this person and this person was kind of like looking away and sort of like distracted and maybe looking at their phone or whatever, and you didn't know that this was going on, then that's a trust eroder, right? Yeah. Because you're kind of thinking, oh, well, they're being rude or my idea sucks. And some people, depending on who you are, some people will go external and be like, that person's a dick, they're being rude, you know, whatever. And some people go internal and be like, oh, I'm shit, this is a terrible idea, I'm bad at pitching, you know. And both those takes are not like true, because the real issue is that this person is going through something utterly unrelated. And how much better to just know that. And then you see this person doing that and you're like, oh, okay, that's fine. They just probably got a text from his wife, yeah. You know?
That's great. I'm so glad I asked for that. epic. Yeah, now would kind of like to delve deeper into kind of kids and how that sort of affects you, because you gave some examples just then of like people often are thinking about their kids, which obviously is something I haven't experienced. But first, you also mentioned the benefits of like having good people around you for management consulting and the difficulties in startup. But I mean, with startups and things, it seems almost more important maybe to have like the absolute best team that you can, like trust on and have these things. So how do you go around like hiring the right people, and do you have any good tips around setting sort of culture and making sure you do interviews in the right way? Because you kind of, yeah.
This is something we think about a huge amount, because there is almost nothing more important than getting the right people in. So I think there is a playbook, and there's a couple of things we've implemented that have been really, really useful. One is, there's a book I recommend to anyone interested in this, and it's called Who. It's actually quite hard to Google this because it's just called Who. But yeah. if you look for like Who and then stick some other words like, you know, guide to hiring or something like that. And it's an incredibly practical, and it goes through the stages of interviews and specific questions to ask at the specific times. And it takes you through this structure, which we just use entirely. We entirely lifted our process from Who. And it basically says you start off with a phone screen and you only ask 5 questions in that phone screen, and it tells you exactly the right phrasing and exactly how to ask them. And then you kind of go through to this longer interview and it tells you exactly the format to do. So we started doing that and we found that really, really helpful. One of the things that it emphasizes is putting a huge amount of effort in defining exactly what you want this person to do in the role, and the idea that a lot of people will hire based on very vague idea about what the role actually is, but you should try and get as concrete as possible. So we started implementing that. And then one of the problems that we found with it was we were extremely undiverse as a group. And we especially started reflecting on this, you know, in the time when everyone else was as well. And like big, that Black Lives Matter summer when, you know, we had reflection sessions, like what could we do and stuff. And after that, after those reflection sessions, one of the things we decided to do was implement what we call blind hiring. And it's a bit that goes on at the front of the rest of the process. So we now don't do any form of CV screen. What we do instead is we ask 3 or 4 blind questions, which are really tailored to like things that we want this person to be able to do. And the first step of the application is just answering those 3 or 4 questions. And we don't attach names, CVs, anything to those answers. And then what we do is we split up the answers and we get them to be blind double marked. So we split them up from each other. And then we also get 2 people to mark them. And then we interview the top kind of 5-10%, whatever the pass mark that we decide is. And then what that has meant is that a bunch of people who we feel like we would have ruled out because their CVs like didn't have the blue chip names on them or whatever, but they're actually amazing, they get through. And then also the other side where we find that a lot of people whose CVs look really good, but actually their answers are not that great. And, you know, it's much, much more important to judge people on what they can do rather than like where they've been in their lives. So we've made some wonderful hires. And as soon as we started putting that in, unfortunately, we actually haven't seen that much impact on our diversity yet. But we have seen the quality, the average quality of our hires has just gone up and up and up.
Oh, that's great. Can you give me an example of the 4 sort of questions you might ask for just like a given role, just to get some context?
So some of them are role specific. So we might say like, we're about to launch a job right now on our website where one of the questions is something like, what are the main factors you would think about if you had to arrive into a fast growth organization and lead a team of 20 people you didn't know? Something like that. So that's role specific, because obviously this is a role where they have to do exactly that. And then we have some which were just favorite questions of ours that are not role specific. So we almost always have a feedback one. And it's like, because we are obsessed with growth mindsets, just like you. And so where the question is something like, what's a recent example of feedback you've been given and how have you incorporated it to improve your performance? Something like that. And it blows me away how bad the answers are to that. Like, I would say I've probably personally marked many hundreds of answers to that question from applicants. And I would say like 80% of them will give a piece of feedback that it basically boils down to like, why are you so great?
It's like, yeah, classic.
It's like positive feedback, which, you know, I think you can answer that question with a piece of positive feedback. I think it's harder, but I think it's possible, but like to do a good answer. This is not a good answer. Their answers are like, yeah, you know, I was told that I should like do even more of the really great thing that I was doing. I'm like, come on, we're looking for someone who is like thoughtful and, you know, really driven to be constantly improving. Like these are the things that we're looking for in this answer. But that's why it's a really great question, because you just immediately isolate the people who genuinely are like thoughtful about their own performance, and it really separates people out. And so then you get some people who demonstrate vulnerability in their answer, which means they're going to really fit into our culture as well. Because if you write an answer where it's like, I was terrible at giving presentations, I suffered from anxiety beforehand, it had this effect on my presentations, I got this specific feedback, I went away and learned this thing, I still find it hard, but I'm much better at it now. You know, like that kind of like story arc is just, you know, that person is just going to fit in at Koru Kids because we're just all about that kind of thing.
Nice. That's awesome.
And now for a quick ad break. I am so grateful for LinkedIn Jobs, as they have been supporting the podcast for a year now and genuinely are keeping us alive. So just a quick shout out saying that they're awesome. And now to actually specifically tell you about LinkedIn Jobs. As an entrepreneur, startup founder, or any kind of size business, it is just hard to find and hire the right candidates these days. That's why LinkedIn Jobs makes it easier to find people you want to talk to faster and for free. I've been using a lot of different hiring tools in my career as a founder for the last 10 years, and LinkedIn Jobs has been the easiest to use, and it's given me the best results. And it's not surprising. You can create a free job post in minutes on LinkedIn Jobs to reach your network, and far beyond your network. It's the world's largest professional network of job seekers with over 770 million people on the platform. You can focus on candidates with just the right skills and experience and use screening questions to get your role in front of the most qualified people for the role. It's why small businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs as the number one in delivering quality hires versus the other leading competitors, who I don't think I'm allowed to name. Anyway, LinkedIn Jobs helps you find candidates you want to talk to faster, and every week, nearly 40 million job seekers visit LinkedIn. So post your job for free at linkedin.com/growth. That's linkedin.com/growth, GROWTH. Post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the recent example of feedback you were given, and how did you incorporate that into what you do?
Oh, that's a good one.
Well, thanks.
We spend a lot of time on feedback at Cory Kids. And so we have every 6 months, we have feedback sessions for each person. Like, it's not like feedback season. It's more like every 6 months for each individual. So what happens in everyone's feedback session, including mine, is I will nominate like probably between 5 and 10 people to come along. We used to do them in person in a room, and now we do them over Zoom. And they'll come into the Zoom waiting room, and then one by one they'll come in and give me feedback. And I'll ask like 2 or 3 specific questions of things that I would like feedback around. And then there's always a kind of like, is there anything else you want to say? And I got this really good piece of feedback from one of my team where they said, like, as a company, we define our goals, and we might define like 3 main goals for the quarter or something, 2 or 3 main goals. And then you go off and you work on things that aren't those goals. You work on other things because everyone else is working on the goals and you're like working on the next things. But the problem is that you create an energy around anything that you work on because, like, you want to talk about it and you're kind of excited about it, and you basically pull, like, your energy is kind of like a gravitational pull. And so are you aware that when you do this, you're actually pulling people away from what is meant to be our, like, main company goals? And I just thought this was such a cool piece of feedback as a leader to have, that I do that. So the way I changed, I guess, was I tried to be more vocal about the actual company goals of the moment and like project more energy and enthusiasm and like try and put some of my gravitation. I can't change who I am, right? Like if I project energy, that's what I do. You know, if I have a great gravitational pull, whatever, that's what I do. But what I can do is try and make it pull in the right direction. So I tried to just be more like chatty and effusive about our actual current goals, and not kind of mentally bank that like they were going to get done anyway, so I didn't need to get excited about them, and not be so focused on the new stuff that I was doing.
Yeah, that's one of the best things I've heard. I am 100% that. Like, I find it impossible to do things when I know other people are doing them. This is why I'm not very good at a job, because I'm like, I can hire someone to do my job. What's the point of me doing it? Which is why I like being a generalist that can just go and do whatever no one else is doing in the company, which is definitely a problem I've now had with not really being the one like leading at the forefront of the actual company goals that I'm expecting everyone else to go and do. But I've never thought about it like that. So I'm really happy for that person's feedback as well. So yeah, thanks so much. That was super interesting. Great interview questions that you ask. And I like the that style of feedback. Cool. So just firstly, did you start Cory Kids when you had kids yourself? Is this a problem that you noticed, or was it something that you realized you were going to have because you saw friends with kids and things? That's like a yes or no.
Yeah, both happened at once. So I was CEO of this online doctor service, and I had my first baby, and I started becoming aware of how difficult childcare was. And my whole career background by that stage was always in healthcare. And I was really used to healthcare system. I had worked in the NHS as well. And I kind of just assumed that there was a childcare system that was basically functional. And it blew my mind when I discovered that there wasn't one. And I find this is a big misconception by non-parents, and including me back in the day. Like, people sometimes think that what we've built is like a marketplace for childcare, where kind of people who want to provide it and people who want to consume it kind of come and transact. And that would work if there was enough supply, but there isn't. This is the problem, was one of the many problems with the system. There literally isn't enough childcare of the kind that people actually want. So there aren't enough people who want to work flexibly in the right places. And so what we've had to do is actually create those people. And we've now trained like some enormous number, 15,000, 10,000, some huge number of childcarers. So it was basically through my own experience and then also through hearing stories of my friends. And what struck me about the stories of my friends is they were all a slightly different story, but they were all terrible. Mm. You know, they were all like someone who had decided they couldn't have another kid because they couldn't afford it because of childcare, or someone who had had to give up their job, which I knew how hard they'd worked to get in the first place, and their career because they couldn't afford the childcare. Or someone who was moving out of London to be closer to family, even though they didn't really want to, because it was the only way that they could get childcare. You know, just so many variants of this, like sort of symptoms of this fundamental broken system.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Did you find the place that sort of gave you specific statistics on that to sort of build your business case when you were starting? Or did you just kind of intuitively feel like this problem wasn't being met and so it was like, I'm just going to do it. I don't need to like do a survey of 5,000 people or find a statistic of...
I spent a lot of time talking to parents, looking at existing stuff out there. I remember I spent a lot of time looking at like Gumtree because that was quite a big way that people found childcare. And I remember being very surprised that I assumed that people wanted full-time childcare, but actually most of the ads from parents were for part-time. Mm. And I now know that that's because part-time is so hard to find that like you have to basically like do an ad for it.
Interesting.
But so I spent time just looking at the market like that. But then I was a great believer in the kind of lean startup, like launch early, you know, launch something silly. Just as a reason, I was a huge devotee of Paul Graham's essays. I remember I basically read everything that Paul Graham had ever written. And, you know, one of the things he says is the greatest benefits to launching early is that it gives you a reason to talk to customers because you're talking to them about something, which is just a bit easier. And, you know, they'll call up and try and figure out if the need is great enough, which in childcare it is, like they'll call up not because you've advertised what they want, but because you haven't quite and they want to know whether you can do the thing that they actually want. So I just launched with any old thing, basically. And all of a sudden, when I got close enough, I had to try a few times before I got close enough. But as soon as I got close enough, my phone was like ringing off the hook and I could just talk to people about what they actually wanted. And then we evolved our proposition quite a lot, actually. And because we started off the original thing, I say we, it was only me. I you know, you call yourself we for ages when you're just me. But I started off focusing on babies. But then for the next probably like 3 years or so, we just focused on older kids aged 4 to 10, which is quite a different segment, actually. But we kind of found our way to that.
Yes, really interesting. Cool. Big advocate of Paul Graham essays. I need to put them all together into like just one giant PDF and read them on my Kindle or something, because I find it hard reading things online and stuff.
The How to Start a Startup series is really good. That's the one where he kind of brings a bunch of stuff together. I mean, I think it's quite dated now because it's mostly from like 2006 to 2009 kind of thing, but there's a lot of eternal
proof. It's pretty timeless around just get something out there as quick as possible and talk to customers as much as possible and do things that don't scale as principles. Cool. So how did you manage your day if you're getting lots of phone calls and actually get stuff to happen out of interest? Because I struggle with like trying to talk to customers and customer support versus actually doing anything.
Yeah, I think the very first thing I did was, so it was just me, and then I got an intern, was the first thing I did. And I remember she came through like a UCL scheme where UCL paid half and Santander, for some reason, paid the other half. And so she was free to me, which was great. It was like a no-brainer. She was brilliant. And she ended up going off to like Deutsche Bank and like becoming a data scientist. So she was like this very, very smart, incredibly nice, like lovely intern. So she kind of took a lot of the operational stuff on initially and gave me a little bit of headspace. And then I hired my first full-time employee. And she was someone who I had worked with previously. And so I knew what I was getting. It was a really easy hire to make for me. And she knew what she was getting because she'd worked with me. And she was someone who was just a very, very wonderful and unusual like unicorn person where she's very strategic and very analytical and very smart, but also so willing to get her hands dirty, like totally no ego at all. and kind of really up for startup life, which is just the absolute perfect like first person you want on your team. And then the next person, we hired someone to do our customer service. And for that role, I hired the smartest, nicest person I could find, the like combination of those two things. And that's the combo I've always go for. Like, I want people who are as smart as I can possibly find and also super nice. Often we say humble, like the real quality I'm looking for is it's humility rather than niceness. And so I hired the person I could find who was the combo of those two things. And all of those people, the intern, she left and went to Deutsche Bank, but the other two are still with Coro Kids now, and they've like advanced and been promoted and they're now really senior and have developed just so much. It's another reason why I'm a big fan of just hiring the people you can with the most potential, because it's so invaluable. I mean, it's really priceless, like a few years in, to have people who've been there from the start and who know the business inside out and who can grow. Because I've seen it happen before when the early people don't have so much potential and it can get a bit messy because they want to grow and they want to manage the people who come in after them, but they're not the right people. And that can get quite awkward. So I'm a big, big, big believer in like the very first people hire incredibly.
Yeah, cool. That's something I've made mistakes with before. And trying to get the right people is super hard. Hence why I was asking in depth earlier around that. But that's some really good advice to think about. And yeah, I've had some people who like either couldn't grow so much, or people that would have grown, but then due to my own other capabilities of fundraising and stuff, I couldn't keep on long enough. And another thing is I often get people who are like very entrepreneurial to the point where like I teach them too much and then they go and start a business straight away. And it's like, oh, damn it. Which is my own fault for not making it like grow quickly enough to keep them around. So they kind of go and do the other things.
Oh, it's so hard. I mean, in this game, there's 1,000 ways to screw this up. Every day it's like, what am I going to fail at today?
Definitely. You know, it's my so number hard. One song that I listened to last year was its main lyric is every time the sun comes up I'm in trouble. I'm just like, I just put that on because it's got a really nice like fun melody, but it's also super depressing. But I'm like, it's fine. Fire everywhere, but I'm gonna be chill about it. And Spotify
exactly.
Knows me.
I think we use that phrase actually, fire. We talk about that internally a lot. I think it's the LinkedIn guy Reid Hoffman. I think he uses the phrase fires you let burn. Like a lot of the startup thing is about deciding which fires you're going to let burn, because you just cannot physically put out all the fires. You can't do it. So just stop beating yourself up about that and just like consciously say, okay, well, that's a fire I'm going to let burn.
Yeah, it's definitely something, but you can kind of get a bit too comfortable with too many fires burning and then you're like, actually, I should probably have dealt with that one. It is actually maybe a priority.
There's 1,000 ways that your house could burn to the ground.
Yes. So I've really enjoyed this interview, and we're nearly at the end of the hour. Is there anything I haven't asked you that you really feel you should mention?
I should probably do my job and say that we are hiring. We're always hiring. We're particularly hiring engineers and also marketing people. But we've also got some very cool operational roles as well. So if anyone wants to build the world's best childcare service with us and be part of our incredible culture and incredible team, and I really do mean that, they should check out our careers site.
Cool. Are those for roles only in the UK, or do you accept remote people, especially like engineering and things?
Generally, they need to be resident in the UK. We don't mind if you're physically somewhere else, like for a while, that's totally fine. And it can be anywhere in the UK. The reason for that is it's just tax reasons. Sure. It just gets really complicated and we can't deal with like weird health insurance and stuff.
Cool. Thank you. Then what is one of your own first memories that is kind of vivid from when you were a very young child?
Does it have to be an interesting one? I have a lot of like mundane. I remember a dog when I went to Australia on a trip. I lived in Canada when I was little for 1 year. When I was 9, and I can basically date everything in my childhood to like either before Canada, in Canada, or after Canada. So I have many very specifically Canadian memories of like sledging in the snow or skating on the creek outside our house or like going to Montreal or whatever.
Interesting. Do you remember the first time you did something that really scared you, maybe whilst in Canada?
It's not a Canadian memory, but in New Zealand, I used to spend a lot of time outdoors and in the mountains and on camps and stuff. We used to go camping all the time. And I remember swing... Do you know what I mean by swing bridges? I don't know if this is a Kiwi term.
I think like the bridges that sort of are made of ropes and they have like wooden things yeah. and a swing aloft.
I mean, they literally yeah. swing. Yeah, a swing bridge. So you would very often in where I come from, when you go into the mountains, you get these really big raging rivers and you have to cross them by, there'll be like some trees and they will have put up like a rickety swing bridge and it will literally be made of like wood and rope. And you have to go over it. And it's, they're always fine. But I do remember that. When I think of like childhood fear, I think of like going over swing bridges.
Okay, cool. But you always managed to cross. You have any like consulting with your parents?
I remember going on school trips actually over these things. And there would always be one kid in the class who absolutely refused yeah. to cross the swing bridge. It was like trying to take a donkey across or something. They just refused. There would be no alternative. So you'd put the poor kid, this was never actually me, but again, I remember this, like, because you'd have the entire class over the other side, like looking at you. I'm yeah. sure it just got worse.
Wow. That's funny. I can definitely picture that happening. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Then what is one of the kindest things someone has done for you?
So I recently, I got COVID in sort of October, November, and I was meant to go on this retreat with like seven other founders. And we're in this kind of small group that meets regularly together. We meet once a month and we're sort of like friends, but it's also like massively a support group. So we're meant to go on this retreat and I couldn't go because I had COVID. And I was so disappointed. And they wrote me this letter, which was like, each one of the seven of them, they folded it over and then like wrote another thing and then folded it over. You know how you do that thing? It was so nice. It was like about, you know, what they valued in me, whatever. I actually couldn't read it. I like opened it up and I couldn't deal with the emotion. And it took me a really long time. In fact, because they sent me a WhatsApp of it. And you know how WhatsApp pictures, they get deleted, like if the other person doesn't, whatever. So I actually had to ask for the person to send it to me again because it took me so long to actually get to it and read it properly. And it wasn't because I didn't value it. It was because it was so kind I couldn't handle
yeah,
it.
Wow. Yeah, it's funny that, yeah, I think a really well thought out message is like huge. Oh, that's lovely. And yeah, something I quite like doing is actually sending someone like a physical postcard and like, but putting like quite a lot of time into writing something that's kind of magical and stuff. But yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I sent my friend, I'd stayed at his house a few days, whilst I was in London, like I sent him some candles for Christmas. So it was like kind of small and cute. And, like, wrote this message being like, oh, no, I can't remember. I remember putting some time into it. Like, he way preferred the message to the actual candles. And now I wish I could have the quote.
Oh.
Great. Is it worth finding right now? I'm going to go for it. It's not going to take long. It's here. But the point being that, like, actually, if you just put a bit of time into it, you can make a big difference. Merry Christmas. These candles look calming and cute, which are attributes I'd like to be associated with. Hopefully they smell delicious, which is something I'm also working on. Thanks a lot, Sam. And he just told me, like, this is the best message I've had all Christmas. And I'm like, yes.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah, it just took me, like, 5 minutes to work out how to say something more than just sending a gift. And, yeah, thought our message is useful, I think. So anyway, that was that. Cool. Then one last piece of advice of parting wisdom. If you could talk to yourself before you'd started this, what would you say?
Everything is going to take longer than you think, cost more than you think, and be worse than you think.
positive message. Love it. Yeah. It's so true, though.
But it's fine. Yeah.
But it's fine, I think, is the important part that you didn't quite say straight away.
Yeah.
Or maybe, but it's worth it. Great. Thank you so much. This has been really brilliant. I've really resonated with a lot of this advice. So a lot of notes.
Cool. Well, it's been lovely chatting to you. And thank you.
My pleasure. Great.
Cool. All right.
Ciao.
Later.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Growth Mindset podcast. Before you head on to another episode, what's your biggest aha moment from today's discussion? You can share with us your insights and join us on Reason FM. Reason FM is a social podcasting app and the best way to discover new podcasts, connect with hosts and other listeners. Also, don't forget to tune into the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast with me and my co-host Nico, and we expose you to a different perspective and dive into the world's most thought-provoking and inspiring books. That's all for this episode, and with that, keep learning and keep growing.